next election year, in 88 days' time, the people of the UK will go to the polls to elect, to choose, to decide who the next government are going to be. Now, I know that for some of us, politics might be a complete turn-off. I appreciate that. I understand it. But I want to say just two things before we begin. The first is the big picture. Politics might seem dry, maybe even confusing. But it is really important, I think, for Christians to contribute thoughtfully to the way that our nation is run. So if you like, we need to think, how does the gospel shape the way that we live as citizens of our nation? Which is why later on I'm going to tell you how to vote. The second is more personal. Over the next 88 days, and no doubt for the week or so afterwards, we'll be hearing debates and discussions on the TV or radio. We'll find politicians perhaps even on our doorsteps. And all of us will at least have one conversation, I'm sure, with somebody about politics or something relating to government, what they do and why. And we need to be able to approach those things through the lens of the gospel, understanding how we as Christians can engage. And so that's why we're doing this series. And we won't be able to answer everything in every talk, which is why there's 4 weeks thinking about it, because it is a really big and important area. But I want to introduce our reading to you. Our reading is taken from the Old Testament book of Daniel. We heard a little bit about it before. And it surrounds a guy called Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon from 605 BC to 562 BC. He is a real, genuine person. I think sometimes we forget that. This guy is a genuine character from history. His story is a real story. He was incredibly powerful. Here's a picture of the Ishtar Gate from Babylon. And it has this inscription, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, laid the foundation of the gates down to the groundwater level and had them built up out of pure blue stone. Upon the walls in the inner room of the gate are bulls and dragons, and thus I magnificently adorned them with luxurious splendor for all mankind to behold in awe." Here's a guy who thought a lot of himself, who had a lot of power, and they're in Berlin, those gates now, so you can go and see them. This is real. So think, as you're hearing Joe read, modern day equivalent, Barack Obama, Vladimir Putin, and listen in with that in mind.
The reading's from Daniel chapter 4. If you have one of these black Bibles, it will be on page 895. It's the whole of the chapter. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last, Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, "O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation." The visions of my head as I lay in bed were these. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to the heavens, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it, and the birds from its branches. But leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and gives it to whom he will, and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached to heaven and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, Chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O my king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. He was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, Is not this great Babylon which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers and his nails were like bird's claws. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lords sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble.
Great, thank you, Joe, for reading that to us. There's a lot in there. I want us to think about this idea of who's in control, who's in charge. That's basically where we're thinking this morning. We're thinking in the terms of this idea, government and God's sovereignty, who is in control? And in the beginning, in creation, right in the back of at the start of the Bible, in Genesis 1, we read God. God was there, the Most High, you might want to put in there. So here he is, he's appearing. There he is, the Most High. And in Genesis 1, God creates, doesn't he? He creates the whole of the earth. And we read in Genesis 1:26 that God made people in his own image, and he gives them dominion over creation. And so the Most High creates people in his image and gives them power. They are, if you like, rulers. So from the very beginning of creation, human leadership is a means of expressing God's own rule. His leadership. They are, if you like, rulers are physical representations of God amongst creation. And that is a big responsibility for any leader, for anyone who's in charge. Paul picks up on it in the bit that we read earlier on from Colossians chapter 1. Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through Jesus and for Jesus. That's kind of what that's saying. Rulers are there to represent Jesus. And that gives their responsibility a bit more shape, I guess, specifically. Now the way that governments should rule, and the relationship that Christians have to governments, will be fleshed out over the next few weeks. We won't be looking at the detail of that per se. But it is worth noting that rulers and government is not plan B for God. It was there in the beginning. People there as part of God's plan to rule creation for his purposes. But people, rulers, are fallen. Rulers are imperfect. Rulers are not as we were in the beginning. Now, the interesting thing from Daniel is that I think that actually, in spite of the fact that we're fallen, there is potential for leaders to be really good for society. So have a look, for instance, at verse 21. Talking about Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, says this, he's the tree whose leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, in which there was food for all, under which the beasts of the field found shade, in whose branches the birds of the heavens lived. You see, there is potential as the king for providing for his people, working for the benefit of his people. And so we can see that actually that governments can provide well, which is why I think God still keeps them there for us. But we can also see the impact of the fall in Nebuchadnezzar. We begin with verse 4. He's there in his house, at ease, prospering in his palace. I guess that's the kind of idea that we get of most kings, isn't it? Someone who's there, sitting there quite comfortably, quite happily, while everybody else is getting on with their daily lives, prospering, at ease. But that kind of prosperity and that ease leads him to pride. And that pride is there in verse 30. Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence for the glory of my majesty. And now you see, when we think about fallen rulers, what Nebuchadnezzar is saying, and this is the instinct of every human heart, is look at what I've done. Look at what I can do independently of God. He doesn't say, look at the power and the responsibility that God has given me. He says, look at what I've achieved for myself, for my glory. He's proud, isn't he? That is what the Bible calls sin. And all of us essentially have got rid of our responsibility to the Most High. We live as if he's not in charge, as if he's not there. That's our sinful nature coming through. But in spite of this, in spite of that temptation that we have to rip up the, to do things our way, God doesn't rip up the blueprint. He still uses fallen, imperfect people in roles of government to rule as his representatives. Governments are not bad, per se. There is potential for good, and I sincerely believe, and this might be controversial, who knows, I sincerely believe that the politicians we have in this country genuinely want good for our nation. And we had that rotten parliament, didn't we, where people were kind of fiddling their expenses. But I genuinely think that our politicians want what's best for us. And so maybe we ought to perhaps hold them in a little bit more honour than perhaps we do. But that's an aside. We need to be clear, though. We need to be clear that no leader is going to be perfect, because in Adam, nobody is perfect. We all want to be independent of God. We all want to do things our way. And that's true of all human nature and all human society. But interestingly, what God does is God basically says, in a different way to Nebuchadnezzar, no, you're not in control. I'm in control here. God often gives us reminders that he's around. It doesn't just have to be in dreams. It could be in a whole host of different things. But for Nebuchadnezzar, God's reminder was a warning in a dream. A warning to turn away from his pride. Verse 26 and 27. It says this. Your kingdom shall be confirmed to you. So it'll be taken away, then confirmed to you from the time that you know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. Basically, what Daniel's saying is, and what God is saying through this dream, is Nebuchadnezzar, stop being proud. Stop thinking it's all about you. Instead, practice righteousness. Practice mercy for the oppressed. So it's important to recognize, and this comes in the whole area of the sovereignty of God and human rulers who have fallen, that God doesn't necessarily endorse every policy that Nebuchadnezzar was making. He's saying to him, don't act like that. So we cannot assume that just because somebody has been given responsibility and authority by God, that they have a blank check to do whatever they want. God's sovereignty doesn't work like that. So just because someone is in power, it doesn't mean that they have a God-given right to do whatever they want. But the problem for Nebuchadnezzar, as I say, was that he acted in this way. He acted as if he was the ruler and there was no one to whom he was accountable. He clearly didn't heed the warning of verse 27. Instead, he carried on regardless. In spite of warning, he was so self-obsessed that he assumed he answered to no one. Safe because of his worldly power, his influence. I'm in charge. I'll do what I want. It's all about me. Now, any student of history will tell you that this attitude is dangerous. Because when there's no accountability, when the rulers think they are ultimately in charge, then those regimes tend to end up increasingly brutal. Here's a list of people from the past century. Mao Zedong, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, Nikolai Ceausescu, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, Slobodan Milosevic, Joseph Tito, Than Shwe, Kim Jong-il, Robert Mugabe, Saddam Hussein. We've had some pretty bad leaders in our world recently. Totally, terribly brutal leaders, totally corrupt. And we wouldn't want to live under those kind of leaders, would we? Let's face it. Some of them were originally elected, but gradually their governments became increasingly totalitarian, answering to nobody, nobody to hold them to account. One of the interesting things about all bar two of those people was that they're atheists. They're atheists. They practically acted in exactly this way. We don't have to answer to God. And the result was sin runs rife. No way of stopping it, seemingly. No way of answering back. But Nebuchadnezzar reveals that whether people believe it or not, they are still accountable to the Lord. The Lord warned him about his pride, and his warnings went ignored. But the Lord continued to deal graciously with Nebuchadnezzar. Firstly, verse 31, he shows that he is in control. Nebuchadnezzar was saying, look at all these things that I've done in verse 30. Well, the words were still in the king's mouth. There fell a voice from heaven, the Lord speaking, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. God took away the kingdom from Nebuchadnezzar. The man with supreme earthly powers was cut down to a stump by the Lord, humbled in his arrogance, made to act like an animal, unshaved, unwashed, unkempt. I bet the people who once knew him just scoffed at him. The one who was so important, now utterly humiliated, everything taken away. The Lord proved that he, not Nebuchadnezzar, was in charge. But interestingly, this is very merciful behavior of the Lord, because it's another opportunity for Nebuchadnezzar to repent, to turn. In the end, verse 34, at the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. He learned an important lesson that actually everything he had was from the Lord in the first place. That the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And that lesson was worth living. He doesn't blame the Lord for his humiliation. He praises the Lord. So verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just. Those who walk in pride he is able to humble. And I reckon that in the end, his rule second time round was better than the first, because it was associated with a lengthening of prosperity and righteousness and mercy. Now, I just want to get very briefly personal, because it might be that this mirrors some of our own experiences. Because the path from pride to praise is always humbling. It's realizing that we cannot do life without God. And in the moment of knowing that we're totally reliant on the mercy of God, we respond with thanks for that mercy. So it may well be that many of us know what it is to go through that valley of humiliation, but be brought out on the other side of praise. But interestingly as well, so many of those leaders I just referred to ended in humiliating circumstances, yet were still proud. Hitler, Mussolini, Ceausescu, Saddam Hussein. In spite of the fact that they were publicly humiliated, apart from Hitler, who committed suicide silently quietly in a bunker, which is pretty humiliating in and of itself, all of them still maintained their arrogance and their pride in the face of basically being proved for what they were. Their pride was so ingrained in their attitudes. And it may well be that, as I said, that people have thought, well, the reason for their attitude was that they weren't accountable. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about this week is this idea of democracy. Because what we find is that rather than allow rulers to do whatever they want, we try and find some way of keeping them accountable. And so the world's answer is democracy, is voters. Voters saying to the government, you are responsible to us. So, for example, if we think for the in terms of verse 31, sorry, the kingdom has departed from you. Who is it that can say that? Well, it's the electorate, it's the voters. So we try and be the ones who put people in charge. In a recent survey about global priorities conducted by the United Nations, they thought about all the different things that are really important: clean water, sanitation, environmental sustainability, equality, support for the poor, education, healthcare. People in Europe and North America put government, honest and responsive government, second. The second most important thing for the world, behind good education. More important than clean water, more important than everyone having food, more important than healthcare. That shows that actually it's probably quite a big ideology for us. We think that democracy basically can keep people accountable, can stop people from doing terrible things. And that idea has led us into wars. George Bush, Tony Blair, look at Saddam Hussein in Iraq. What do? They think the answer is to bring democracy, to make the government accountable. Maybe it's Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, Mubarak in Egypt, Assad in Syria. Let's support the opposition in order to bring democracy. I wonder if there's a sense in which democracy is a modern-day idol that thinks that actually we can get the new creation by having accountable leaders. Now, I'm not saying that democracy is bad, though. I agree with C.S. Lewis. He said this: I am a democrat, a proponent of democracy, because I believe in the fall of man. I think most people are democrats for the opposite reason. A great deal of democratic enthusiasm descends from the idea of people like Rousseau, who believed in democracy because they thought mankind so wise and good that everyone deserved a share in government. The danger of defending democracy on those grounds is that they're not true. I find that they're not true without looking further than myself. I don't deserve a share in governing a hen roost, much less a nation. The real reason for democracy is just the reverse. Mankind is so fallen that no man can be trusted with unchecked power over his fellows. I think that's true, isn't it? We can argue for democracy, not because people are good, but because people are fallen. And that's why I think, in many respects, God gives us democracy in order to check the powers of people who would be absolutely corrupted by absolute power. Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't suddenly have become a good, godly leader by electoral reform. No, instead, we need to pray for our leaders that they remember that they are first and foremost accountable to the Most High. And that depends not on a change of behavior, but a change of heart. That's what we need to be praying for our leaders. We need to pray that they realize the Lord can give and the Lord can take away. That they would create policies that are right in line with the character of God. That they would practice righteousness and show mercy because of who God is. And that comes from the heart. More on that in a minute. But the final thing that I want to say is this. Where do we fit in? Where do you fit in all this? What difference does it make to us? How is this going to affect our conversations? Well, on May the 8th, the votes will have been counted and the Prime Minister will be elected. Who chose him? Well, we did. But the Lord did. Because we see verse 35, that the Lord does as he will among the host of heaven, among the inhabitants of the earth. So the Lord, either we believe that verse 31, the kingdom has departed from you, the Lord saying that, might say that to David Cameron, or is it us? It's that kind of little tension thing that's going on there, isn't it? How does it work? Well, we are responsible for the way that we vote. But also, God is sovereign. And the two go hand in hand. And I believe in a God who's big enough to reconcile those two things. Because I can't. So when we vote, the temptation is to feel like we are doing God's job, being the kingmakers. Like we're the ones to whom our politicians answer. The ones with the greatest power and authority. We decide the fate of the nation is in our hands. But what I want to say, finally, is in that position, there are five things to take away. And as I say, it's all about the heart. Because we need to learn the same lessons as voters, that we are responsible to God first and foremost. So just like Nebuchadnezzar, we need to actually realize the same lessons. And this kind of acronym doesn't work in that order necessarily, I'm sorry. But yeah, hater wasn't that good. And I tried all those different words, but heart, here we go. So they're not in necessarily any order. But here are some reflections that I've thought of as those who are responsible for the sort of being God's servants. Because your vote is a way of serving the Lord. Firstly, be humble. The Christian is to act with the change heart of the new Nebuchadnezzar. Recognizing we're servants of God and responsible to God for the way that we choose to vote. So pray about it. Pray about how you're going to vote. Because that's an obvious way of remaining humble. Puts us firmly in the place of servant rather than master. Pray that the Lord will help us to be wise in our decision making. Second, be active. Educated even. Yeah, educated. I'll move down in my notes. Be educated. Educate yourself. In other words, vote on the right principles. The human tendency is going to be to vote on the basis of by my power for my benefit. Looking for the party that will benefit our own interests. But that's not the priority for us. Our priority is the idea of mercy and righteousness. So ask, which candidate do I trust to demonstrate a character which is in line with the Lord's character? Practicing mercy and righteousness. Which party's manifesto is most in line with those priorities? The thing is, it's actually really difficult to do that. It's difficult to do it because we live in a media environment where everything is spin, sound bites, and a series of polls rather than actually detailed engagement at the issues. So pray for our media as well because they have a role in all this. Be educated. Thirdly, be active. Vote. Simply. Election turnout suggests that people are largely disenfranchised by politics these days. Whatever the reason, whether it's feeling that their vote doesn't count or that all politicians are the same, not everybody chooses to vote. God's sovereignty doesn't reduce us to innocent bystanders waiting for the outcome. Instead, God's sovereignty means that he uses us. Your vote is a way of serving the priorities and purposes of the Lord in giving the kingdom to who you will. Fourthly, be realistic. All the political parties want your vote, so they identify themselves, or they identify problems that we experience, and they promise to deal with them. It has led to over-promising and underachievement of successive governments. It's led to, actually, the financial ruining of our economy. We can't expect politicians to be able to deliver everything that they promise. So maybe we need to lower our expectations this side of the new creation and not expect our politicians to deliver perfection. And actually, maybe we ought to encourage others to do likewise in our conversation. To actually speak to others about what government's trying to do rather than beating them up with a stick because they're not achieving what they've promised. And then finally, and most importantly, on May the 8th, whoever wins, be thankful. Be thankful, because whoever wins is the person to whom God has given the kingdom. That might be the different person to the one that you voted for. But God does not, in that sense. God's sovereignty allows us to be able to say that whether we win or we lose, God is still sovereign on the 8th of May as much as he is on the 7th of May. So be thankful for that. And don't put your trust in human rulers, because God is the one who's ultimately in control.
So a bit of question time and comment as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes when we've done this series in the past, we've had a panel up here. But if there are things you want to comment on and encourage us with as a church family, then please do speak up. Paul, let me ask you a question just to get things going. You quoted a number of leaders from the last century. Predominantly they were atheists who were pretty brutal. As we look at this century since 2000, things might have swung. Mm. It may well be said, actually, this century so far, it's religious leaders who are profoundly brutal.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing at the moment. So what is it that is unique? I mean, it can't be any God that is the right one. Tell us a little bit more about the uniqueness of the Christian God, if just to help our thinking through getting things in the right order there.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you. So I think as we look ahead to the next century, it may well be that with the rise of, in particular, militant Islam, the leaders of those nations will say, I am accountable to the Most High. So they'll say they're doing God's will, God's work. And so there is an accountability there. The question is, to whom that accountability really is. And so in democracy, we would say, well, you're accountable to the people, and the people as a whole decide what's good. In the same way, in militant Islam, people would say, well, Allah decides who is good and what is good. I want to say that the Christian God is unique because of those values of righteousness and mercy, which you wouldn't find elsewhere. And we find the ultimate example of, we talked about imperfect rulers. We find the ultimate example of what a perfect ruler looks like in the Lord Jesus. Now, there will be more on that in session 4, I think. But the Christian is to model themselves in their character, not on a God who is, as Stephen Fry might describe, capricious and angry and silly, but actually on a God who is loving, merciful, gracious, compassionate, slow to anger. And actually, if you want to find out more about what that God is like, then come along tonight.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you. Other comments, questions? Louise's hand went up first. Could just repeat that for the recording, basically. So Louise's question, it's absolutely right. Agrees, yes, we should take our responsibilities and vote. But you turn up to vote the choice is a bunch of folks who basically are four things that... bottom line, as Christians, we seriously are very concerned about.
Yeah, I totally agree. In the past, I've used you're not supposed to tell people who you voted for, but in the past, I've used my ballot paper, spoilt it, because for that exact reason. So I think it's important to have
just
a say.
Just a little bit more about the spoilt paper that does get counted, doesn't it?
It does get counted, so I'm making sure that my voice is... it's heard in one sense, so it's counted, but it's not saying I'm counting or voting for any one particular candidate. I think later on we'll come to sort of good policies and how they fit with God's kingdom and the like. But without preempting that too much, I think the problem is that the priorities of God are remarkably right-wing and remarkably left-wing. And I think God has the ability to hold those two in a way that we necessarily can't. So the temptation for all the parties is to head to the middle ground. God says, no, you need to be more loving to the poor, and you need to make sure that you're more just on your on various things. So there is no one party that will instinctively fit. But I think actually there's something about the character of leadership which is probably important for us to think about and look at, especially when it comes to our local MP. There might be he might stand for a party that you disagree with on a lot of things. But if you think he is a man of integrity...
Or she.
Or she, sorry. So yeah, sorry. Of course. That he or she is a man of, or woman of integrity. And you can trust them to practice righteousness and show mercy, then I think probably they're quite a good person to support.
It's a really good question. We need to keep talking around that whole thing. So thanks for that, Dunk. Okay, so the question is really one about status quo, I suppose. Dunk has just asked, is if God is absolutely sovereign, then what part do we play potentially in regime change, being active in that point, and how does that fit in with the sovereignty and the overruling of God?
Great question. It's one of those difficult things, isn't it? I can't necessarily give you a hard and fast rule. You can talk about various individuals in the past. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer would be a good example of someone who stood against the rule of the Nazis in 1930s Germany, in 1940s Germany, and ultimately gave his life for that. I don't think we're in a position to make hard and fast rules on that one. And I think in some ways it becomes a question of conscience as much as anything else. So if you in good conscience can say, I am trusting God in this one, some people might say, I'm going to pray more. Other people might say, I'm going to do this. And it doesn't mean to say that there's one or other, but I think what we certainly need to be doing, bottom line, even if it isn't actively standing up against, which it would be for some, we certainly need to be praying for our leaders that they go through the experience of Nebuchadnezzar. And that, in many respects, is the most powerful thing we can do anyway. I think the danger is that we end up, so I can't remember who said it, but the danger is that the church becomes political rather than Christians think politically.
Good point. Just a comment on, you mentioned Bonhoeffer there. It is a very, very thick book, biography written about Bonhoeffer a year or so ago. It is, you know, for anyone who doesn't even normally into reading, it is a fantastic read. It's riveting, it's gripping, and it goes through all these various issues of a guy who loves the Lord deeply, passionate for the gospel, very sensitive man, a pastor and a real thinker, but in the end, it is looking to see Hitler removed from where he is, so pastor and spy. What a combination. So, Chris, next question. Okay, question there, repeating for the recording there. John's asked, is democracy good for sustainability? Interesting and good question, yes.
I think it can be. So, I think... I don't know what you're expecting me to say in some respects. I don't know if there's a... I think that sustainability is all about looking out for future generations and caring for them and valuing people. And democracy, often in terms of the majority rule, ought to look in that direction. However, democracy isn't as good as us as stewards caring for God's creation. So we shouldn't see democracy as the answer for all the way of securing sustainability. The other element is, as well, it depends on what the majority think. So actually, if in our sinful nature, our tendency is to think about us rather than future generations, then democracy isn't good for future generations. It's not good for sustainability. Because what we'll find is that people will prioritize their own needs for the time being rather than the needs of future generations to look after theirs. So we end up with the situation that we've had economically, where we bankrupt the future generations in order for our own prosperity. So I've just contradicted myself, as I've thought. But potentially not. So democracy is always going to be a case of the majority rule. So someone once described it as two wolf and a sheep deciding what they're going to have for dinner. And where you have a majority which is interested in their own interests rather than future generations, then it's not good for sustainability, no.
John, is there anything else you want to add to that yourself?
There might be more to that.
I'm coming, I'm going to give you the microphone. Is there anything else you want to comment on, John?
I'd like to just maybe change tack and ask a question which Duncan raised, and that is, in the rise of Nazism in the 30s, why was it that Christians didn't more oppose Hitler? Was it because they believed in the sovereignty of God?
Good question. I mean, from my reading of the biography of Bonhoeffer, the answer is no. But
yeah, there was a significant bunch of them, actually, who thought they could reform the Lutheran Church. So yeah. stayed in, thinking they could change it. And in the end, they couldn't.
Yeah.
And it was only a few, like Bonhoeffer, who said, quote unquote, if you're on the wrong train, there's no point in running down the corridor in the opposite direction. They realized that a bit late. Anyway, a final question then. Fee at the very back. Last question.
Thank you. I think, can I speak on that one?
Well, we probably need to repeat it for the for the recording there. So, Fee's just asked, would it be a good idea to perhaps invite some of the local MPs or folks who are putting themselves forward to become members of Parliament to perhaps come along and spend some time with us or with us and other churches?
I think that's a great idea. I really do think that actually that is a good way for us as a church to become increasingly discerning. Now, obviously, we're spread across the city, but thinking about city centre candidates, if we don't get them here, then maybe we as a congregation ought to think about going to the places where there are debates or hustings and those kind of things in order to actually have our voice heard. So if your MP drops something through your door saying, do you want to come to this event or that event, then don't think, oh, that sounds like the worst thing I'd ever want to do. Maybe actually think this is an opportunity to serve God with my vote and with my voice.
Paul, one final thing to say as we draw to a close, just to try and draw things perhaps a little bit together and introduce the final song. The musicians can be coming out.
Brilliant, yeah. Okay, so, God is ultimately sovereign. He gives us human rulers to rule according to his priorities and his purposes, but our role in that is to be humble and act as his servant, which is why the final song, Take My Life and Let It Be, consecrated Lord to Thee. Let's stand and sing.